тише коло вранське, де бойки, а тише коло моїка.
Hey there, and welcome to Keep Calm and Choir On, a podcast about the power of singing together. My name is Ryan LaBoy, and this week I'm so excited because we have our first married couple on our show, Paul and Brittany Rudoy. They're great friends of mine here in the Twin Cities, and I'm just so excited they could join us for our show today. To tell you a little bit about them, Paul Rudoy is an award-winning composer, conductor, tenor vocalist, and entrepreneur. Deemed indisputably unique, confident, and innovative, Paul's compositions are commissioned and performed worldwide. As a tenor vocalist, Paul performs with professional ensembles nationwide, including Seraphic Fire, the Santa Fe Desert Chorale, and Cantus. Paul is also the co-founder of Consortio, an online consortium building platform with tools, services, and a marketplace to help musicians connect and facilitate new music commissions. Soprano Brittany Rudoy is an active vocalist performing both locally and nationally. With a flexible and vibrant soprano voice, Brittany's performances have spanned genres such as oratorio, musical theater, jazz, choral, and solo recital work. Brittany is also a skilled pedagogue and vocal instructor. Managing a thriving vocal studio for 8 years, Brittany has had experience teaching a diverse body of students in age, background, and skill level, and currently teaches at the University of Minnesota Morris and Southwest Minnesota State University in Marshall. Paul and Brittany, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, I'm so excited to have you here, and I'm glad that we could make it work to get both of you on the show. And it's just fun to see you from your home in two different spaces making this work.
It worked well.
For those of you who are listening from North Hennepin Community College, you may know that our chamber singers were going to do the Brahms Zigeunerlieder this spring, and Brittany and Paul were going to be two of our guests coming in to work with us on that project. So I'm glad that even though we couldn't quite get them to campus to work the Brahms with us, we can get them here on our podcast to talk with us about their experiences and their musical journeys and just the power of singing together. So Brittany and Paul, before we dive into the interview questions themselves, just a quick check-in. How are you doing?
We're doing well. We are, strangely enough, I think, weathering being locked down really well. Paul and I have two separate spaces to work in, so we've been able to get stuff done without bumping into one another too much, unless we want to.
Yeah. It's been fun to figure out how to utilize this time to learn. That's been my favorite part, is to learn a bunch of different programs and skill sets and stuff that I've always wanted to learn, but haven't had the time or the brain space to do that. And when you are not employed, you have brain space.
Yeah, absolutely right. You might not have the money, but you have the time. I totally get that. And I mean, and this podcast is sort of a project in the same vein. You know, I don't know that I would have had the thought to start this or have had the courage or frankly the time to get it going if we didn't have to stay at home.
Yeah, I should say it has less to do with employment and more to do with just being stuck in one place and being forced to think about everything in your life through one location.
Totally. And like they say, also, necessity is the mother of invention.
It's so true.
Because we, you know, Brittany, you and I both teach as part of the Minnesota State system, and, mm-hmm. you know, we're still teaching. So it's a necessity, and we have to figure out how we're going to do it. And this is my attempt at a creative solution to that. So.
Mm-hmm. And it's been really wonderful actually to see how, I'm sure you've seen this as well, Ryan, how adaptive our students have been as well.
Yes.
I have to say that they have been thriving, not saying that their lives are great on the other end, but however they're doing it, they are doing it and they are trying their best. And I think that that's hopeful for me as a teacher, yes, but also as a person to see. It's a good reminder, like they can do it, I can do it too.
So speaking of those impressive students, as you know, we have a series of interview questions for you today coming from the students at North Hennepin Community College. They were given an extended biography, and thank you in advance, students, because this week it's a doubly long extended biography because there are two of you. Mm-hmm. And so they came up with a series of great questions to ask you individually and both together. So I think we should just dive right in.
We are ready.
All right. Well, let's take a journey back to the beginning of Brittany and Paul and talk a little bit about your upbringing and the influence that had on your decision to pursue a career in music. So I'll start with you, Paul, because one of the interesting things from your biography that we learned is that you attended the American Boy Choir School. So I'm wondering, before we actually start with the couple questions we have, can you tell us a little bit about the American Boy Choir School and what made it so special?
Sure. It was incredible. It was a school that was a boarding school for middle school boys in Princeton, New Jersey. And I was from fairly rural Florida at the time, 9, 10 years old. And then the boy choir came down and sang a concert and collaborated with the children's choir that I was a part of at the time. I remember coming into the church and seeing them come up to, a couple of them come up to my mom and ask for where the bathroom was. And my mom says, yeah, it's over there to the left. And they go, and I turned to my mom and I said, you talk to them.
Nice.
And I just thought they were, I thought they were just celebrities. Mm-hmm. And mom was like, yeah, they're boys like you. They just really like to sing like you. So then they had this audition process where after the concert, you would go up and they would play some chords or some melodies or something and you would sing it back. That could tell them whether or not you sang in tune, whether or not you had any sort of potential to be coached, whether or not you wanted to be coached, which I did. All the things. I like loved every bit of it. So I ended up there for 4 years throughout my whole middle school time, 5th through 8th grade. And it was an amazing experience. We practiced sight reading an hour a day, which
in middle
for
school.
A boy, if in middle school, which for a boy, if you like it, is so fun. I mean, I just showed up and they gave me little Kodai books and we just kept practicing. And I just saw it as little puzzles to learn in the mornings at 9 a.m.
So another question in that same vein, Paul, comes from my student Josie, because it sounds like from a pretty early age, you did like drink the choral Kool-Aid and like you chugged it down. Mm-hmm. So my student Josie says, you've been singing since you were so young. Did you ever fear that you were missing out on other things growing up?
I think I was too oblivious, too obsessed with choir and singing to notice. I think in high school, there were moments when I was wondering, you know, I think in another lifetime, I would have tried to go for musicals. I really enjoy them. I find them, as especially looking back now as a composer, I find musicals to be so effective at getting to a really meaningful part of our human experience, more so than other forms, in my opinion. Right. But in high school, I was singing in so many choirs, I didn't think, well, I want to sacrifice all those choirs in exchange for all the time that I would need to spend in one or more musicals. Yeah. I guess there's a part of me that wishes I could have done that, but now I have so much experience in the choral realm after spending time in the community choruses that I spent in high school. And I know that seems weird. I mean, I don't know how many high schoolers spend a lot of time in community choruses, but for me, and again, thanks to my mom suggesting it, when I started high school, I was able to learn a lot of masterworks with people at that time at the University of Arizona in Tucson, where I would have never had that experience, and that was a huge benefit.
That's interesting that I didn't know that about your high school experience, that you also sang with community choirs once you graduated from the American Boy Choir School. So I guess maybe a question that I have off of that is, do you feel like this life was groomed for you?
You know, as I said, there were a couple of moments where I wondered whether or not I should try something else, but I never, ever considered anything that was totally not singing. It just was very clear to me that I couldn't get enough of it, and that I was defined by my singing. I mean, whenever I met somebody, I was that geeky, very, very short boy that said, have you listened to Shostakovich? Like, Whitaker is so cool.
We would have been friends as children.
Yeah.
Brittany, you've been sitting there so patiently, and I've seen a couple eye rolls as Paul and I are geeking out about our choral boyhoods. You were actually the opposite in your growing up in Sandstone, Minnesota. And so let's switch gears a little bit and talk about how you ended up where you are. I have a question coming from my student, Ayan, and she says, when you talk in your biography about not being drawn to vocal music at an early age, do you look back and wish that you would have done things differently? So we know from reading about you, singing was not your jam until well into high school. So tell us a little bit about your history with music and singing, and how did you get turned on to it?
I just didn't see the joy in what there was to do in choir. And that might have been where I grew up, because choir wasn't that popular. Band was, because a lot of people were in it because they needed a music credit. Mm-hmm. Choir, on the other hand, had always been like the underdog. Very few people were in it. We had fluctuating instructors, frankly. I think the choir teacher that was there when I first started, she stayed for maybe 2 or 3 years, and then they were gone. That was the longest somebody had been in that position that I remember anyway during my schooling, which 3 years in one person schooling, that's a big chunk of my time in school.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about an age where students need continuity because mm-hmm. they need to develop relationships because they're starting to understand themselves away from their family unit.
Yeah.
So that is a really hard time to have a large transition in teachers or several transitions in teachers.
It wasn't until, as many of you know who have read my bio, I guess, it wasn't until I was in high school that I stayed in choir because I did start to enjoy it. Mm-hmm. When I was in high school, again, I was forced by my choir director to be a part of the musical chorus mm-hmm. in 9th grade. And I was so annoyed. I did not want to do it. I was so frustrated.
What was the show?
I know. It was Children of Eden.
Oh, my.
Oh, it has a great theme song. Children of Eden, where are you? I don't remember the rest of the words. Oh, yeah. I think once I started singing in the chorus of the musical and being around the other people and enjoying not just making music with them, but getting to know them as friends, I think mm-hmm. that's when the switch flipped for me, mm-hmm. was that once I could experience just being with people, I think that that was a learning moment at that time as well, because it was a community theater production.
So Brittany, we also know from reading your biography that you were really passionate about music theater, as you've been alluding to. And so I have some questions in that regard for you. Our first question about music theater is going to come from my student Anna, who says, your early life seemed to have a big impact on your music and theater path. What was the big moment that made you choose to be a theater and music major? So again, you're saying you come from a small town where there wasn't a huge music and theater culture. How is it that you found yourself wanting to pursue this as a career?
I was actually filling out whatever test it is that then you get your scores back and it tells you what areas you're strongest in.
Oh, like a career aptitude test?
Yeah, so I took that and I was looking through, and then you kind of look through all the options. And I remember sitting in the library of my high school, and I realized in that moment that I would be bored doing anything else for the rest of my life.
We know that when you got to college, you studied at Concordia University, St. Paul. And when you got there, there wasn't a musical theater major. So you ended up getting a dual degree in music and theater. Mm-hmm. But then from there, you sort of had this epiphany regarding classical music and the likelihood that choosing a life of music theater might mean that you had to give up classical music. So I have a question for you from my student Shai, who says, what makes you say your sole focus on music theater meant you would never sing classical music again?
The problem that I came upon was that, yes, in school, my degrees were very separate. As we've alluded to already, in school, musicals are separate, right? Like theater, musicals kind of fall under the theater realm umbrella, mm-hmm. and then choir and band are in the other. And I would say that, unfortunately, that is kind of the case with musicals, especially when you're getting out of school and you're doing auditions, because what people want to see are not that you are good at singing in choir.
Are you a triple threat? Can you sing? Can you dance? Can you act?
Exactly. Coming out of school, when I was graduating, I was just working on musical theater rep for my auditions. Mm-hmm. And because in a musical theater audition, you need to prepare usually 16 bars of one song you sing through, and then you also perform a monologue. So again, very theater centric mm-hmm. in that sense. And I knew there were no classical musicians that I knew doing that.
Where did you fall in love with classical vocal music or classical choral music? How did that come into the picture?
I actually think this all kind of stems from me taking piano lessons when I was young. Because when I was young, I loved playing any classical music that my teacher gave me. I loved it. But for some reason, I never really made that connection. But then when I got to college, I think it literally started when I started my degree, because I was singing choral music with the choir. I was singing jazz music with a jazz choir. I was singing classical lieder and art song in my voice lessons. And I loved it. I loved singing Lieder, which is German art song. And I would say that that kind of began right away when I had my first German piece that I sang mm-hmm. and has continued since then. And then when I went to graduate and I knew that, well, if I want to really do musical theater as a job, suddenly, as yes, so weird as it sounds, I had an epiphany that if I do this, I need to commit all my time and energy to auditioning for that stuff.
Yeah, the audition circuit can be really grueling.
Yeah. And frankly, I grew up with the example of you get a job when you need a job. Yeah. And musical theater, if I was going to have a job in it, I needed to focus on doing auditions and doing musicals. Like that's mm-hmm. That's the only thing I knew. And the choir world and classical music world was very foreign to me in terms of the outside working world. Mm-hmm. To touch on the one question that was a while ago, if I were to be slightly sad that I didn't do something in my past, mm-hmm. it would be that I wish I had asked sooner. Mm-hmm. I wish I had asked my voice teacher or my choir director what exactly I should do to get into a more classical world of performance. So that's when I reached out, asked my teacher, and they said, well, the best thing you could do is get your master's in vocal performance. So at least you're around it more and you're exposed a little bit more to the industry and kind of what it entails. And then I applied and went to the University of Minnesota for my master's and I loved it. I went for vocal performance and my main reasons were take vocal pedagogy and learn about how to teach other people and learn about my voice, take voice lessons from a really good teacher, learn about my voice. And I would say those are the two things that I came away with the strongest. Because I decided to do that, you know?
Well, and that's where we met. So you also walked away with some pretty awesome friendships.
Exactly.
So, Paul, I want to loop you back into the conversation because you've been so wonderfully and patiently listening to Brittany and I gab on about music theater. So I want to talk more generally about singing. Both of you are such wonderful singers, which is why I wanted to bring you to campus this spring to do the Brahms Aguena Lieder with us, because I know that you would just be perfect for that project. You're so fun and playful and relatable and accessible in a way that I think my students would really enjoy. But in reading your biographies, we came to know that being a singer and being confident are not necessarily mutually exclusive things, right? And so there's a little bit of faking it till you make it. So Paul, I have a question for you coming from my student Aubrey, who says, you mentioned feeling insecure about your abilities and how it allows you to see where you need improvement. Do you think having confidence is important as a musician? And how do you find balance? You particularly, Paul, have a really interesting philosophy on the impact of insecurity in your work. So can you talk to us a little bit about that and address Aubrey's question?
Sure. Yeah, I actually want to loop in my good friend Neil deGrasse Tyson into this conversation. He has an amazing quote that actually totally relates to this. The challenge in life is to know enough to think you're right, but also the challenge is not knowing enough to know you're wrong. And to me, that is truly difficult, especially in the arts. So I'm often insecure about my pieces in particular. I'm getting comfortable with the idea of not being the best singer in the room. I haven't been ever, and I knew that. But now I'm realizing that if I want to do four or five different things rather than just one thing, if I don't just want to be a singer, there's a benefit mm-hmm. there because I don't have to be the best person in the room. I have my own path that includes X, Y, and Z. As long as I'm good enough to be confident in doing my job well and that I'm not holding others back, there's a big difference there, I think.
Well, Paul, you talk about not being the best singer in the room, but I just want to push back on that a little bit because you're clearly one of the best singers in the room. And that is evidenced in part, not entirely, but in part by the fact that you sang with the professional male ensemble Cantus for a number of years. That would suggest that you're a pretty darn good singer to be able to land one of the few fully professional jobs in the country as a tenor vocalist. Can you talk to us a little bit about what your experience with Cantus was like?
I should take a step back. I make this joke all the time, but there is a high level of truth to it. I got into Cantus out of undergrad. Mm-hmm. And it was at a time when they had already had several auditions for an open slot. And I sent in stuff assuming that I wouldn't hear back, not even knowing that they were a full-time ensemble. My boy choir sang with Kantus when they were still in college, and I knew of Kantus through that. That was about it. Hmm. They got back to me and they said, hey, we do have an opening, and would you be willing to send some more materials and go out and have an audition? But because I already had something set up, I just assumed that they would either take me if they found that I fit, or they wouldn't. So I had no, I didn't have a lot of stress in the audition process. So when they let me know that I got the job, it was very clear to me that, and I say this as a joke, but it's also a level of seriousness, that they were desperate, that they saw potential in me, but that I wasn't the person that maybe they needed at the time. Hmm. They just saw the potential. And so when I came in, I realized that I could use this as a way to learn to get better as a vocalist, considering I had just figured out how to cover as a tenor that same year I auditioned. I mean, I didn't know what I was doing,
right?
You know, but I knew what I was good at. I knew I was good at tuning. I knew I was good at choir. And I knew I was good at hearing people out and learning from them. I enjoyed somebody telling me what I was not good at and getting good at that thing.
Yeah.
You know, and I was around a bunch of people in Kantus who had masters in voice or pedagogy. So I would turn, I'd be like, hey, I'm not singing this pretty well at all, as you know. What do you think I could do to be better?
Yeah.
So in essence, Kantus to me was a master's on the job.
Paul, you just highlighted that there's sort of this paradox that can exist of being both confident and humble in our singing. I have a question in a similar avenue for Brittany, coming from my student Isaiah, who says, after being a soloist with the Minnesota Oratorio Society, you said that you gained confidence. Can you talk a little bit about the benefits of having confidence in your ability to perform? And what can you do to develop this kind of confidence for performance?
I think that sometimes confidence is found innately. There are some people that are frankly just better at it than others, right? Like we've all met that person, no matter what the field, who has confidence, sometimes misplaced, but they still have it. And there's a part of you, if you are like me, who is very self-aware and sometimes self-deprecating, that I think, like, God, that person is annoying.
So then what about the Oratorio Society experience changed the game for you?
I performed with them in the summer between my 2 years at the University of Minnesota getting my master's. And I had basically had a really hard first year of my master's because I, as a soprano, I have a younger sounding voice, which can tend to take a little longer to mature and have that more classical sound, you know, nice space, lovely vibrato, you know,
that sort of polished chiaroscuro.
Yeah. And I didn't have that. And some of that, it took me a long time to learn this about my own voice, but some of that, yes, was some of my technique. But over that summer, I realized it was also just age.
And you actually were a young singer.
Yeah, exactly. I was a young singer. I was, how old was I? 23, 24 maybe, I think. So I actually had a summer where I was listening a ton. When I did practice, I was paying attention to my body in a way that I had never paid attention before. Mm-hmm. And I kind of took that summer to reacquaint myself with the love of singing that I had and also acquaint myself with the new sensation of loving my voice.
Mm-hmm.
And that took a lot of patience. Like when I would practice, I stopped if I was getting frustrated. I didn't keep practicing, unlike before when I would have just like plowed through.
Right.
And I actually think for me, being a person that does not just have this innate out the window confidence, I think for me, my confidence was born in the knowledge that I was the one and only person who took the time, was patient with, and learned what my voice could do, how my voice felt. I knew that more than anybody else in the whole entire world. Mm-hmm. Nobody, not even my voice teacher, could tell me all the ins and outs of my voice like I could. Mm-hmm. And I think that knowledge paired with the work I did in prepping for that performance, mm-hmm. because I did all that work and because I learned how to be confident in my own abilities as a singer and my own knowledge of my own voice, my confidence then going into the performance was higher than it had ever been before.
As a guest on the show, we ask you, Paul and Brittany, to bring music with you that you love, that you would love to share with us. And one piece that you brought, Paul, today is from your time singing in Cantus by a composer named Maura Bosch, and it's called The Turning. I'm excited to talk about this piece. I didn't know it before you sent it along to me, and I think it's wonderful and impactful and tells a really important story from a perspective that is so unconventional and really causes you to pause as a listener and ask if it's deserving of the beauty it's given. Mm-hmm. And so I just kind of want to turn it over to you first to ask what inspired you to offer this piece as an example of the power of singing together.
My first year in Cantus was the year after this piece was premiered and commissioned. And so they brought it on tour for, 80 concerts a year. And we did it for 2 or 3 years. And it's a very uncomfortable experience because the context of the piece is that Maura Bosch went into anger management classes and spoke to 9 men who had to be in those classes. They were court ordered and spoke to them about their experiences, which is really interesting because these conversations can be conversations that any of us have, right. But somehow because these are court ordered anger management classes, these people are put in specific social locations in our minds. And so I was wrestling with this piece. I should say, I love the piece. I was wrestling with it and continue to wrestle with it because Maura says about it, that these men aren't asking to be forgiven. They're asking to be heard. Mm-hmm. Which isn't the goal of being human, to be able to be heard. But for many people who are incarcerated or who are in these court-ordered anger management classes, they have made mistakes, which they're ideally aware of, but those mistakes haunt them. Right. And I just found it to be really a meaningful conversation. And what I think is really interesting is that you'll hear this in, we decided to listen to just the third movement today, but the whole cycle is on the album While You Are Alive. Maura did a really interesting thing. I mean, this is her soundscape. Mm-hmm. It's a little disjunct. She calls herself a melodic composer, and she is, but it's very disjunct because every line, all parts have a melodic contour. So these lines jump in and around each other. So you'll hear it. It feels very disjunct. But then it also, the harmonies kind of clash in different ways to offer clarity to the words.
Right. Well, when you Cantus are singing them, those dissonances are so steely and tight that it really is text painting.
Yeah, that's a really great way to say that. I think it's just extremely, and it's so bare. It's so clean that all that's left are the words.
To give our audience listening a little bit of context about both Maura Bosch and the piece The Turning, I would love to just share a bit of information about her and her composition. Maura Bosch is a living composer. She was born in 1958 and actually currently lives in Minneapolis. She is a graduate of Hart School of Music in Connecticut, which actually is also where Paul graduated from, his alma mater. Did her master's and PhD research at Princeton University, but actually there's a large space of time between those two degrees. So she stepped away from her PhD research for a time, and then after having 2 kids, came back to it in a really interesting way. Her doctoral thesis is called Everyone Can Compose Music, and was centered around her experience in creating a composition curriculum for her 2 children, and then a curriculum that could be taken into a general music classroom in any school in the country. Maura also was a composition fellow at Tanglewood in Massachusetts and has spent extensive time living abroad in both England and Amsterdam. She moved to Minneapolis here, the Twin Cities, and actually had her own music theater company, Corn Palace Productions, for a number of years that ran in the 90s. And that certainly has influenced her composition. She's written 4 operas and a number of choral works, and also considers herself an unashamed melodist. So a little bit about the piece, The Turning, in particular. It was commissioned in 2007 through the American Composers Forum, which is located here in St. Paul, and was done also in relationship with this organization called the Tubman Family Alliance. Maura Bosch was the composer in residence with that organization. It's a network of shelters for abused women, and she composed this piece, The Turning, based on her experiences in that shelter. But as Paul has already mentioned, she sort of flipped the narrative as she was composing for this all-male ensemble to tell the story from the perspective of the male abuser who is also broken and hurting, right? And I don't say that as a means to undermine the pain of the victim and to not prioritize that, because super important, and it's really incredible work that people in shelters do for abused women. And also, there are two sides to every story, and it's kind of our obligation to listen to it. And we all listen to it on our own time, right? We're not all ready to hear both sides of the story at the same time.
I think it's, I think there's a wide variety. And frankly, any music and art that's worth presenting ideally offers a wide spectrum of results from the people who take it in. And I would encourage people to listen to all three movements. It's not that long. The third movement is what we'll listen to today. But yeah, check it out. It's on Spotify, all the places.
You've already mentioned to us numerous times, Paul, that you are both a singer and a composer and a choral entrepreneur, but we'll get to that third piece a little bit later on. Right now, I want to talk about your composing. So the first question I'm going to ask you really simply comes from my student, Aubrey, who says, how did you get into composing music?
I wanted something to do musically that was alone because I was in so many choirs. So I started writing, I think, toward the end of high school into college for fun. And I never showed anybody any of that stuff. And I just tried to imitate the people that I enjoyed. And then over time, I started writing for my friends. And my friends included Cantus eventually. And then that kind of grew from there.
So let's run with a question from my student, Ben, who asks, how has being a composer changed the way you see music as a vocalist?
As I developed as a composer, I have also developed as a vocalist, understanding my own voice, because I use my voice as the writing tool. Mm-hmm. To write my music. I actually have loop stations where I loop my voice speaking the texts that I want to set. Mm-hmm. And then I listen to that until it becomes sort of a melodic fragment or a melodic contour. And then I create a melody out of that, which then informs my harmonies and my rhythms. And so it all boils down to me as a vocalist, basically writing for myself that I can then create something that I know will be accessible, not just for me, but for people outside, ideally.
Another question coming from my student, Isaiah. He says, for those who are interested in composition or want to hear the latest music, where should they start? Also, what do you think is the best way to keep up with the contemporary classical / choral world?
I would say that the best thing you can do if you are interested in composition is to listen to a wide variety of music. Mm-hmm. Don't get stuck in one genre. While I am obsessed with choral music, I am also obsessed with lo-fi hip-hop. I'm also obsessed with EDM. I'm also obsessed with some pretty intense 90s rock because it reminds me of my childhood. You know, these are very, very different genres. Mm-hmm. And I try to find the commonalities within these genres. You know, why does a very popular single from one genre relate to a very popular single from another genre? I mean, what they have in common is that they were very popular. So why were they very popular? It's probably because they followed a particular form or their form was unique. So you can analyze, you know, when did the verse start? When did the chorus start? Is there a bridge involved? You know, that sort of thing. Try to strip it down to its bare elements and then acknowledge how that relates to, let's say, a choral piece or an instrumental piece. You know, maybe a choral piece has an ABA form, just like an Ed Sheeran song. And that's okay. And you can find that common ground and notice that maybe the reason why it works so well, these popular pieces, are because they have a melodic hook to them, or their harmonies are just so engrossing, right? Things like that. That's how I started writing, was because I was so interested in certain aspects of Whitaker's music, or I was so interested in how folk music like grabbed my attention.
Right.
And then when you're asking, you know, how to keep up with the contemporary classical choral world, I would follow specific groups that are paving the way for others. You know, I mentioned The Crossing. I would definitely check out The Crossing. It's a choir in Philadelphia. And they,
Don Nally conducted.
Donald Nally. They're amazing. And they really aggressively pursue societal change through their work as vocalists and a choir. So I would check them out.
I would recommend checking out Contus and Lorelei, two ensembles you also already mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
If all goes well this fall and the world is up and running in some way, you actually have a pretty big moment in your career coming up in Boston. So can you tell us a little bit about what we might expect to hear from you this fall?
Sure, yeah. So I wrote my second concert length work. Mm-hmm. My first was a sacred music drama that I wrote for a group here in Minnesota for Manu Koram called Sermon on the Mount. Many composers focus on a large form sacred work as an explanation of what they are musically. And so that was my testing ground for a concert length work. The piece that's going to be premiered in Boston in the fall, called Our Transcendentalist Passion, is my result of that focus. And for me, I wanted to focus on the American experience, what a passion in America would look like, would sound like, would feel like, not necessarily in the context of Jesus, but more on what our spiritual principles might be as a communal America. And so our transcendentalist movement, or our transcendentalist passion, is focused on the transcendentalist movement of the 19th century, where there were these free thinkers who were coming out of more strict religious principles and doctrine. And they were realizing that there were a lot of social, socioeconomic, and political issues that were not being changed at the rate that they believed they should be changed. This is talking about, I mean, this was before the Civil War, so we're dealing with things like abolition, we're talking about women's rights, we're talking about gender equality, we're talking about workers' rights, unions, things like that. We're talking about unhoused people, you know, the homeless. These are issues that, surprise, are dealt with today just as much as they were dealt with in the 1820s. The amazing thing was that I was finding that the transcendentalist movement followed the arc of a passion. When you think of Jesus's passion, you think of the crucifixion leading up to the death, and then his legacy as a religious figure. The transcendentalist movement, in many ways, reflects what we currently believe are our ideal socioeconomic and political values in America. It brought out all of these problems. The Civil War, which in my view was the point that this passion could be, you know, the death,
right?
Where the transcendentalist movement had to go away in order to focus on abolition. And by the end of it, it kind of dissipated into the American ether. And yet all of these different issues that they were trying to fix are still plaguing society. And so there are conversations about what this meant.
Well, I mean, that answers a number of questions for my students. So, wow, it's fascinating how your brain is working to combine these different ideas. And I am really intrigued by this idea of composers taking what has been a very traditional and singularly focused form, right, this Christian passion, and sort of breaking it into parts and playing around with it.
The outline of these large form, these concert length works, is based on a lot of this innate gut reaction change to these formats that churches used over the years.
Brittany, we've talked a lot today about your experience as a singer, but I'd like to take the opportunity to delve a little bit more into your work as a teacher. My first question about your teaching comes from my student Avery, because in your extended biography, we ask you to reference the sort of quote-unquote moment that you felt called to work as a music professional. And so Avery says, "It's interesting to me that your moment had to do with learning about the voice and not necessarily performing. Would you say you found your passion to be teaching over performing?"
I wouldn't say that teaching is my passion over performing. I think they run about equal. I do. But I have to say that since being in this field and, yes, learning like the mechanics of the voice and being more comfortable and confident with how this instrument works and how cool it is that everybody's instrument is different, I would then place this like interest in how the voice works and the intricacies of it as a third passion. And I think that it links really well with my teaching, because I get excited to teach others, yes, as a teacher wanting my students to grow. But I think this newfound kind of knowledge and strength I found in knowing my own voice, I love being able to help my students try to get there as well.
So I have a question coming from my student, Caitlin, who says, "As a vocal instructor, what would you say is the most important skill to learn? So if you had to pick one thing for a student to learn from you, what would it be?"
I think that the skill that I most want my students to take away from their voice lessons when they're with me is the ability to go into a practice room and learn how to focus internally to feel what their body is doing. When they're doing things, I want them to be able to have a sense of awareness of what they feel their body doing, what their body is doing in reaction to something that they're thinking. And the more they can turn their awareness inward and focus on sensations, the better off they are, because then you can always recreate that feeling.
I have a question for you coming from my student Ben in the same regard, who says, "How does being a voice instructor help you with your own practice of singing?"
I think it keeps me open and more imaginative to solving problems, because at the end of the day, being a voice teacher is but like being a doctor. You see your patient, your student, you listen to them, and you kind of diagnose what's going on with their voice, which is just what the doctor does when you come in and you tell them what your issues are, or what, you know, you're, gosh, I've been feeling this way, or I physically have this pain. The doctor diagnoses and they say, well, seems like maybe this is going on. As a teacher, I do the same thing. I listen, I diagnose, and I think, what am I hearing the student do? What am I not hearing the student do or seeing the student do? And then the further step for a teacher is that, yes, diagnosing is really great, but then you also need to come up with a solution. So I think that teaching any age level has really helped me pinpoint in on some of the things that like I always need to work on. But then also on top of that, I'm learning from my students, because when one thing sticks for them and then they think, oh gosh, that really worked, and then I say, can you explain to me what you just did? Sometimes my students come back with the most brilliant things to talk about. And now those things that those students have said are part of my toolbox. It's another tool for me to throw at them and say, hey, guess what? I had this one student say they felt this. Why don't you try that out? So I'm learning from them.
Well, and you can apply that to your own singing as well.
Exactly. Exactly. So if I get stumped, you know, I was like, I wonder what my one student said about this the other day. They said this cool thing. And then I can try it out. And honestly, sometimes it works.
So in addition to being an amazing composer, you also are quite the entrepreneur, Paul, and you've recently co-founded this business called Consortio. I have a question coming from my student, Shai, who says, can you tell us more about Consortio? What is a consortium, and how do you go about spreading the word for such a thing?
Let's start with what a consortium is. Generally, the traditional way to fund a new piece of music is to have one commissioner, an ensemble, an individual, spend some money for a composer to write a work. But because of how many hours it takes to write that work, the cost can be really prohibitive for many people.
Right.
So a consortium is basically taking the full cost of that work and splitting it equally, sometimes unequally, but most often equally, amongst a variety of different organizations. So you might have, instead of one $10,000 commission for a composer, you'll split that amongst 20 ensembles and you get $500 for each ensemble to buy in. Mm-hmm. There are benefits and detriments to that. The benefit is that it's way cheaper. The composer gets a lot more marketing out of it because they get 20 performances, ideally, of the piece. Mm-hmm. The detriment is that you might not be the organization that actually does the world premiere. But to me, I keep thinking, well, if I'm not like the premiere, but I am one of the premiering ensembles and I paid, you know, $500 instead of $10,000, to me, that's a win. And so that's what consortio is. I noticed that there were composers trying to use sites like Kickstarter and Patreon and other websites that weren't really built for what a consortium needs. You need to deal with different payment methods for schools, like purchase orders and invoicing and that sort of thing. We also needed to protect the fact that composers sometimes deliver scores on time and then don't get paid, or they don't deliver on time and then ensembles who did pay are left out in the cold. So we kind of created a process which protects all parties, makes it much easier and more efficient to do consortiums. And we've kind of automated some of those processes through the website consortium. If I hadn't experienced new music in the American Boy Choir, I don't know if I would have considered writing it. And there are a lot of kids who in urban environments and rural environments who are a part of programs and schools that don't have the money to afford $10,000 commissions, but could afford $100 to $300 for a new piece of music.
I especially love what I hear you saying about nurturing that next generation of young composers and giving every young singer the opportunity to feel special knowing they have a piece of music that was made especially for them. And then also to think, gosh, well, if this person can do it, then maybe someday I can do it too.
Exactly.
Brittany, the piece of music that you brought with you today actually caught me by surprise. Just given what you've shared with us in your biography and what I know about your background, I didn't quite expect Byzantine Chant.
I'm not surprised that you didn't expect that.
So how did this piece end up on your list of songs you sent along? What has you so enamored by it?
I had actually listened to this. I heard about it on NPR because it's actually a groundbreaking album in the way that it is, the audio is done. And I heard it. Yes, Paul is gesturing in this video that I was crying because I was. I listened to it on NPR, looked it up on Spotify, and I have a 3-hour drive out to a school that I teach at once a week. And I turned on the album, and within 2 seconds, my eyes had turned to faucets, and tears were just like streaming down my face, and I didn't stop crying for 20 minutes.
I mean, music can be so powerful in that way, and it can really catch you off guard. So to just name what music it is that we're talking about for our listeners, the piece that we're talking about is off of an album called Lost Voices of Hagia Sophia that was put out by the group Capella Romana, based out of Portland. And the particular song that we're going to be discussing comes from this Greek Orthodox liturgy, and it's called Small Litany and Old Caliphonic Antiphon. When we are dealing with Greek Orthodox music, it's music that is often in modes we are unfamiliar with as Western listeners. So what's interesting about this music that we're going to hear is that in the liturgy itself, this music was discovered in 2016, right? And this music was specifically written for the Hagia Sophia Cathedral in what is current day Istanbul, at the time Constantinople, right? And that was the eastern expanse of the Holy Roman Empire, right? So this is a Byzantine chant for the Feast of the Holy Cross, which happens in September. And in the Greek Orthodox Church, it's one of the main feast days in the calendar year. If you are unfamiliar with your Eastern European history, that's all right. I did a little researching too. The Byzantine Empire existed from around 330 to 1453 AD. This space, the Hagia Sophia, for which this liturgy was created, was built in the 5th century, right? So we're talking about a space that is over 1400 years old and still standing to this day. The music that you would hear in that space, because of just the vastness of the Hagia Sophia, was often unison or in a texture that we would call monophonic, which is essentially unison, but there are some like individual riffs kind of that can happen there. So it's not a perfect unison. People are just sort of playing around with the same melody. The Byzantine chant is going to be rich in its melisma. And, you know, when I did some research about this music, about the style of music, and about Hagia Sophia, the title of the church, Hagia Sophia, means holy wisdom. And I found an article that talks about how this is sort of paradoxical, because the vastness of the space would suggest that, like, humans can only have access to so much of the wisdom in the universe, right? That we don't have the capacity to know it all. So in that same vein, one hypothesis about how chant was composed for this space is that it was purposely stretched out to elongate different words and provide emphasis and import to certain words. But also, there were additional syllables injected into the chant lines that purposefully distorted the text. It's thought that this was done, like I said, on purpose, to create a sense of mystery within the line that was being chanted, to reinforce the paradox of both the space that is the Hagia Sophia and the concept of holy wisdom.
It's pretty cool.
I mean, it's really interesting, because I think that many people have this idea of what quote unquote religious music is. Mm-hmm. And because we live in a Western world where really Catholicism or a Protestant, more Lutheran tradition of worship has been a key factor in how we view religion, I think sometimes people can think that religious music is only that. And it makes mm-hmm. sense. You are only aware of what you are exposed to. Right. And if it's not something you want to research, why would you learn something else? Because mm-hmm. it takes time to research it. Just as all this information you gave us, we even had to look some of this up. Right. But I think what's really interesting is you don't have to dive too deep. And sometimes all it takes is just a listen, and you can start to hear some of the exciting differences in that type of music.
Just a little bit about the space itself. So the piece of music that we're going to listen to, we don't actually know who composed this piece, right? So the composer is unknown or anonymous, but what we do know is the space for which the liturgy was written. So the Hagia Sophia, as has already been mentioned, is a cathedral that is in current-day Istanbul, previously Constantinople, at the eastern expanse of the Holy Roman Empire. The Hagia Sophia was built in the year 537 under Emperor Justinian I. It still stands today, as I've already said. It's over 1,400 years old. The dome that is sort of the central feature of this cathedral, that is really the awe-inspiring part of this space, is 108 feet in diameter, and from the ground floor inside of the cathedral to the tip of the dome is 180 feet distance. So it's quite large, and especially when you consider that it was built in 537, I mean, this is an enormous feat of engineering and technology and architecture for its day, and like completely changed the game in terms of contemporary architecture in its time. It was built in, I believe, like only 6 years, which is also incredible considering the Cathedral of Notre Dame took almost 100 years to build, right? So this was built very quickly. It's a very impressive space. For the first 900 years of its life, it was a Greek Orthodox cathedral, right? So built under Justinian I and the Byzantine Empire, it was a Greek Orthodox faith practice. So first 900 years was a cathedral, a Christian cathedral. Then in 1453, it was converted to an Ottoman mosque, right? So then we're talking about the Ottoman Empire, which, again, we're not history buffs here, but it's important to talk about. So it became a place of worship for people who practice Islam for the next 500 years of its life until 1931. It closed down in 1931, but then reopened in 1935 to the public as a secularized museum up until present day. So right now you could go to Istanbul, well, not right now, but theoretically, one could go to Istanbul and visit the Hagia Sophia and see it as a museum. So Brittany, you said that you first heard this piece of music this past year as you were, well, the album was only released in the fall of 2019. So it's a very recent thing. You said you heard it on NPR. So can you tell us a little bit about the group who performed this music and how it came to be on the radio?
Cappella Romana is the group that created this album. Cappella Romana mainly emphasizes early works, and they do live kind of in this Byzantine chant world. And actually, there is a cathedral where they are practicing on a regular basis Byzantine chant. That's kind of the source of their musical output, as it were, for worship. Alexander Lingus is the co-founder and artistic director, who is a professor who kind of studies medieval art and work and music. And that's kind of why they started this group in the first place, to do more medieval music and bring it to light. And they actually created this album of Byzantine chant. And then there was a group at Stanford that are actually audio engineers that worked with a medieval art professor and specialist. And what they wanted to do was, they realized that all this chant was, as you stated before, originally written for and performed in the Hagia Sophia. So they worked with Cappella Romana in crafting basically an auditory journey of this music and creating certain soundscapes based off of the acoustics of the Hagia Sophia. Fun fact, they had a professor, this medieval arts professor, because you, because the Hagia Sophia is a museum right now, you actually can't sing in it. You can't go perform. It's not a performance space.
Right.
It is set aside as a museum specifically to go see, not to hear in. But this professor was allowed after hours to go into the museum and release a balloon that she popped. But the way the balloon pops, it basically covers the gambit of what that sound can do, or the space can do with sound. So then they took, she like had to wear all this like cool gear that recorded this stuff. And then they took that audio information and they kind of crafted it and moved it around the voices of this group, Cappella Romana.
So from Cappella Romana's website, there's this sort of notable sentence that I'll read to you, saying that Lost Voices of Hagia Sophia is the first vocal album in the world to be recorded entirely in live virtual acoustics. It brings together art history, music history, performance, and technology to recreate medieval sacred sound in the Cathedral of Hagia Sophia as an aural virtual reality. So yeah, any concert, I mean, theoretically, any concert hall that they go into, they can bring this this acoustic model with them of the Hagia Sophia and turn that space into that cathedral and take the listening audience on a journey. I mean, this is what's part of what's so cool about being a singer and being a musician, is it's like time travel, right? We get to recreate history and bring it back to life. Whether or not Byzantine chant is your jam, it's just a really awesome opportunity to breathe life through the centuries and to experience just like the faintest glimpse of what life was like for somebody living 1400 years ago. I mean, how cool is that?
Yeah.
To our listeners, when you are listening, I first listened to it when you sent it along, Brittany, just on my laptop. And I was just like sitting at my desk and doing a bunch of research and just listening through the laptop speakers. And I was like, oh, that's okay. But then I was like, oh, ding, ding, ding. I should listen with headphones on both ears so that that cancels out all of the room and space that is the upstairs of my house. And if I listen with both headphones or earbuds in, and I close my eyes and just think about the space that is the Hagia Sophia, it's a really transformative experience. It transports you.
Oh.
As I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, this is our first podcast where we have multiple guests, and not just multiple guests, but multiple guests who are married to each other. I don't know if this is going to be a bit of a minefield with this line of questioning, but I am super excited to ask your perspective. So let's start nice and easy. Question from my student Jackie, for both of you, Brittany and Paul, who says, what's it like to be married to a fellow musician?
It's great.
It's a very loud household.
It's really fun because you know, look, several of our friends, when we started dating, were like, why are you dating somebody who is also a singer or who is in the same field? And I kept thinking, why wouldn't I? I mean, here's an opportunity to be with somebody who I don't have to sit here and spend 10 minutes explaining why I chose X, Y, and Z moment in the when I write, or why I get excited about some obscure art song that I found. I'll just say it, and then she goes, oh yeah, totally. I also should say that I think I like the fact that we are different voice types. You're a soprano, I'm a tenor. That means we're not vying for the exact same positions in the field. So there's not a lot of tension around that.
I don't think that we, contrary to popular belief, we did not fall in love with one another just because we were fellow musicians. I think it also has a lot to do with personality type as well. Paul and I have really learned that we both have different strengths and interests. So yes, we are both musicians, but in some ways it feels like we're doing two separate jobs just under the same umbrella. Sometimes they bump into one another and we can talk about like the same thing. But other times we still have things to talk about within our own separate, you know, jobs that still are interesting and unique to us as individuals. And I think that in that comes this excitement that, well, yes, we are both musicians, so we can connect under that umbrella, but we do so many different facets under the umbrella separately that we can still find differences to talk about. So I think
absolutely,
that too is really important for us.
I mean, contrary to popular belief, just because you're a good singer doesn't mean that you're a good teacher.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And so that could mean that I learn a ton from Brittany, just her talking about what she teaches and how she teaches it. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, I like to say that everybody is a composer. They just don't know it yet. Mm-hmm. And Brittany has proven repeatedly that she has ideas that I could have never thought up. Mm-hmm. I would not be the composer I am today had I not mentioned to her X, Y, and Z excitement. And then she takes it and runs with it with this brilliant idea that I would have never thought of.
Oh, that's you guys. That's so sweet.
Stop. So
I have a question then that asks about how you come together, but also some of the challenges for my student, Sophia, who says, how has music drawn you together or pulled you apart from each other?
Well, physically, music has definitely pulled us apart from each other because being a part of the pro choral circuit means I have to disappear for a week or two, or sometimes three, to go in and rehearse for a couple of days and do a bunch of performances with these various choirs around the country. And that keeps us apart for significant amounts of time.
And I think too, like, We have similar and different musical tastes, so we're not just stuck in the classical realm. So in some ways, music has brought us together because we enjoy sharing that element of our lives. We enjoy talking about what music you've been listening to today or sharing it and listening to certain albums in the car as we go on road trips and things like that. So I think that while it has definitely pulled us apart in some ways, as Paul suggested, him being gone, but also the fact that he's performing a lot, I'm teaching a lot, for sure. Sometimes we both kind of wish we had the other's job, but I think the fact that we communicate a ton and that we do have certain things that we have connected over that while they are small, we have paid attention to them enough to know that they're super important to keep in our lives. And make sure that we make those connections no matter how small. I think that that has really helped us kind of grow past any frustrations that this field has presented in keeping us apart.
So last question for both of you is going to come from my student who also is named Brittany, who asks, have you been in performances together? And if so, how do you keep that life separate? And I wonder if with this second question, what she's asking is, like, how do you guys leave work at work and home at home?
So actually, Paul and I have performed only a couple times. We performed more together in choirs, and that is actually very fun for me. I love it. It's great when there's a whole group of us and I can kind of look over at Paul and wiggle my eyebrows at him. What helps is that when we are at home and we practice for these things, we often practice them separately. So we do our individual work so that then when we do come together on any project, whether it be a recital or a choir, we are able to kind of still enjoy that knowing that we've put the work in separately, but we very much try to keep homework at home and then, you know, work outside of it. Outside, we really do.
Paul and Brittany, it's been so great to have you on our show today. And before we leave, thank you for sharing the wonderful music that you shared with us. I think it's also fabulous that both of the pieces we listened to today are for lower voices, for tenor bass ensembles. So I think that's kind of an interesting angle to the episode. So thank you for that musical gift that you gave to us. The last thing I want to ask you before going is sort of the tagline of our podcast. What do you believe is the power of singing together?
I've been thinking a lot about this, actually, because at this time we can't. Mm-hmm. And I am obsessed with different cultures in the world who are built on singing together. Mm-hmm. You know, Estonians and the Baltic states, many Eastern European countries, they are built on the folk music that was passed down by generations, mm-hmm. Which kept all of their history alive. And to me, this is a blip in the span of human existence. And what's good about this is it will remind us of how crucial it is for us to sing together in whatever capacity. And this is not going to keep us from doing that in the long run.
Yeah, it'll re-impassion us to get back to it as quickly as we can to continue mm-hmm. telling our stories.
We're only human. We have to sing together.
And I think too, for me, to sing together, as we've mentioned a little bit before, for me, it's a lot about the community. And I know that right now it feels like we don't have that. But I think that some of this, doing a podcast where we can get together with musicians and your students can hear this, just knowing that you are a part of a community, and frankly, you're part of a larger community than you think. Because music is so universal that you, just like the person who lives 3,000 miles away, maybe you like the same music. Mm-hmm. Or maybe your friend who lives in the dorm next to you has never heard Byzantine chant because they don't really listen to music much at all. But you know what? Maybe that's something that you can share with them. And I think that the great part about music and art in general is that it can seem really sad that we're not together in a physical space. But I think at this time, art and music is even more important. And actually, you can do it. You can do it by having a virtual choir. You can do it by listening to music and sending it to your friends and family because it's just something you enjoyed. And as you stated, Paul, once we are finally again able to be in the same room together and enjoy music, that makes it all the more meaningful.
I can't imagine a world after this that doesn't acknowledge the amount of community that we sought during this time.
Mm-hmm. Well, Paul and Brittany, I'm so glad that I could rely on you and tap into my community and invite you to participate with us in this podcast. We know from my students at North Hennepin that we anticipated you coming on campus and interacting with us in a different way, but I'm so thrilled that we could find another way, a creative solution to still get you to engage with our students. Thank you for taking the time to share your passions and your stories, to answer questions from me and my students. I'm just really glad to have talked with you today, and I hope we get to connect soon.
It's been really great being here and chatting with you. So thank you so much for having us. In any way that we could participate, it's really been great.
Thanks, Ryan.
Yeah, you're welcome. Talk to you later.
Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Keep Calm and Choir On. And thank you again to our guests, Paul and Brittany Rudoy.
I'd like to additionally thank Christina Rodel-Sorum, host of the podcast Art More Lovely, for her help with co-producing this episode, and offer a huge thank you to my choir students at North Hennepin Community College for their thoughtful questions. If you enjoyed today's music and conversation, be sure to like and follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/choironpodcast, and stay caught up on our latest episodes by subscribing to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or your preferred podcast platform. And as always, you and your friends can find us on our website, choiron.buzzsprout.com.